We'll move to the consent agenda. Do any of the commissioners wish to pull any items off the consent agenda? Does anybody in this room wish to pull any items off the consent agenda? Please call the vote.
We need Commissioner Leonard.
Okay. Please call the vote on the consent agenda.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read the 9:30 time, sir.
Agenda item 453, make Portland a more livable city for all by bringing community resources together to increase home ownership and home ownership awareness among City of Portland employees, retirees, people of color, and families with school-age children.
Commissioner Sten?
Well, thanks, Mayor Pryor. I think we have a short presentation. Danielle, are you coming up? And Art, I'm not sure who all. I think everyone knows the City Council has been focused very hard on an effort called Operation Home, which is to increase minority home ownership in the City of Portland. There's a huge, almost 20-point disparity between the home ownership rate of minority communities and the majority community. A related but not exclusively tied to Operation Home effort is something that we're trying to reinvigorate with our friends at Hometown Bank. A few years ago, started an employer-assisted home ownership program to try and help our employees get their first home. We're a big employer, one of the largest in the city, and we think we pay good wages, and our people, even in an appreciating housing market, ought to be in a position to try and buy a home. And so this is an effort to reinvigorate that program. There's a fair, I think, taking place today, and we're going to work with our bureau managers, our police chief, fire chief, everybody throughout the city to try and get this opportunity in front of our folks so that not only is it the right thing to do, and we believe it'll help stabilize Portland and our schools, it's, I think, going to help inspire, we hope, some of the other employers that are working with Operation Home. So, Danielle, are you going to lead us through this? Great. Thanks, Mayor Potter. Do you want to help introduce this, Mayor Potter?
Well, I just want to thank you folks for what you've done, both with Operation Home as well as asking questions about how we reinvigorate our citywide employee home buying, because I know that it has helped many folks, and I'd like to see even more help. So, Danielle, please go ahead and start.
Right. Good morning. So my name is Danielle Ledesma, and I work for the Bureau of Housing and Community Development and coordinate our affordable homeownership programs. And I'd like to thank City Council and the Mayor for all of your support in our efforts to increase homeownership. As you all are aware, homeownership is one of the primary ways that folks can build wealth for their families and their communities, as well as stabilize their families and housing. And we're seeing more and more how stable housing is an important factor in being able to increase student success because of student mobility. We've seen how students' grades can go down. We also have seen, as we heard with the students from Jefferson, about the low enrollment numbers. And so the city is involved in two homeownership efforts. One is Operation Home that Commissioner Sten referred to. We're trying to increase the rates of homeownership for folks, as well as the school's family housing initiative. We're trying to better coordinate housing policy and planning to work with the schools. And in both of these efforts, in our planning efforts, we've been able to see the importance of, that employers play in being able to increase awareness about homeownership, in that home employers provide wages as well as opportunities to create awareness. And that's why we thought it was so important to really reinvigorate the city's employer-assisted program. And we're so happy to have really good partners with us in Home Street Bank and the staff there that have just been really great in helping us relaunch this, as well as folks at the Portland Development Commission and in the Treasury Department. So we have a couple of folks here today to testify. We have Felicia Tripp, who's the Deputy Director of the Portland Housing Center and a great partner with us. We have Jenny Mielis, who's a city employee who bought a home through the Hometown Home Loan Program, as well as Rich Binion, who's the Executive Vice President of Home Street Bank, who will talk a little bit about how the city has utilized the program. So, Felicia?
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. First, I want to thank Commissioner Sten for setting such a good example in our community by leading the way in promoting affordable home ownership. As most of you know, my name is Felicia Tripp, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Portland Housing Center. I'm currently President of the Asian Pacific Islander Community Improvement Association, a host board member, and a member of the African American Alliance for Home Ownership. And I'm here today to talk about home ownership and how we can make this an option for more Portlanders, and especially people of color. Between 1995 and 2005, the home ownership rate for people of color grew at more than double the pace for the general population and has risen from 43.5% to 51.2%. Having said this, there still remains a 25% point gap nationally in the home ownership rates between whites and people of color, and we need to do more to continue to close that gap. One way we can address this gap is through employers being more engaged in assisting employees to purchase homes like what the City of Portland is doing today. And the Portland Housing Center is here to assist the City of Portland and Home Street in preparing these new home buyers to purchase. Second, we have the issue of an affordability gap between house prices and incomes for our moderate middle-income home buyers. Third, the city's initiative to close the minority home ownership gap presents an opportunity to increase marketing, education, and lending opportunities. Third, Portland is experiencing an influx of young home buyers to the market, some of which are people of color, to afford the housing market. This gives the city an opportunity to work with local builders to create affordable home ownership options closer in the city for people who want to be close to the downtown corridor. I know Sam is working on an option for people in the creative industry, and we're seeing quite a bit of people in the creative industry trying to purchase as well. In the last 9 months, I have seen 303 people purchase their first homes. Unfortunately, half of those people had to have to buy on the outskirts of the city instead of in the inner corridor. In the last month, I've seen 77 people sign up for our services, and 50% of those being people of color. As interest rates continue to stay low and employment rate remains relatively stable, this gives you as our city leaders an opportunity to lead the way in creative, innovative solutions to address the challenges that face our city. In closing, you should pat yourselves on the back because the City of Portland is demonstrating that government and the private sector can work together in an innovative and effective way when it comes to affordable home ownership. Your dedication and commitment stands as an inspiration, and we truly appreciate all that you are doing. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jenny Mielis, and I work with the City of Portland in the Bureau of Housing and Community Development. And about a year ago, my husband and I bought a house through the Home Street Home Loan Program in partnership with the City of Portland. We were recently married and young. We're 26 years old, and we knew that we wanted to make an investment in home ownership now rather than later instead of paying our money towards rent each month. And the Home Street Program, with the partnership with the city, was able to help us do that. We took a class at the Portland Housing Center in 2004, getting ready to buy a house, but we knew at that point we still didn't have enough money for a down payment. So at the end of 2005, we went into Home Street Bank and talked with Jennifer Larson, and she gave us a lot of different opportunities and ideas for loan programs and tips on budgeting on how we could save for the home. And within 3 or 4 months, we were actually starting to look for our own house. We bought our house in the beginning of 2006, and at that point it was a really tight housing market. It still is, but timing was a big issue for us. We needed to be putting a bid on a house within hours of it going on the market for us to even have a chance to be in competition for it. Jennifer was really great. She got us our pre-approval letter fast, and we were able to put in 7 offers. I think our 8th offer was finally accepted on a house, but it took a while. We were finally able to get our own home. The advantage of the Home Street program is that we were able to get a loan with lower fees and closing costs than we would have anywhere else because of the City of Portland partnership. The big incentive of that was that we got to use the money in our savings account directly towards our house rather than on the fees and the closing costs. And we were able to have a little extra money left over at the end for moving and for starting projects in our house. We actually were able to refinish all of our floors before we even moved in. Aside from the financial incentives through Home Street, Jennifer was a big help in giving us advice on how to budget ourselves and save up the money for that down payment. She gave us the idea that we don't know what it's going to feel like to have a mortgage payment to pay. We're paying rent right now. It's a lot lower than what we would can ever get on a mortgage payment. So she told us to pretend we're paying mortgage right now. Take an idea of what we think we can afford and spend that much money on housing each month. Put one portion of that towards rent and put the rest of that portion directly into a savings account. So that gave us the sense of feeling what it would be like to have a mortgage payment, feeling the financial constraints, and it gave us the opportunity to realize what we thought we could afford was actually much higher than we really could afford in real life. And we got to learn that lesson with a safety net of not having that burden hanging over our head of not knowing how to pay our mortgage payment. The other advantage of that was that we were able to build our savings account much quicker than we thought we could. We were thinking it'd take 9 months to a year to save up for a down payment. And with the advice from Home Street Bank, we were able to save up for a house within 3 to 4 months and get into a house quick. So the Home Street Home Loan Program and the City of Portland Partnership was a big advantage to us. It was a huge resource for us being able to move into a home quickly. And it's a good feeling to feel like I work for the City of Portland. I live in the City of Portland, and that was able to help me get into my home.
My name is Rich Binion. I'm with Home Street Bank, and I don't have too much to say after that testimony. Thank you very much, Mayor Potter and members of the Commission for having us and for supporting this program. I think everybody recognizes the benefits of city employees being able to live in the city close to their place of work, and Home Street is pleased to play a small part in making homeownership more affordable for them. And the Hometown Home Loan Program is a good example of how public and private entities can leverage their resources to accomplish more than what either one can do on their own. Since its inception, the 157 City of Portland employees have utilized the Hometown Home Loan Program, including 72 first-time home buyers. Home Street is happy to regularly provide the city with important demographic information on the program users, as such information like household income, ethnicity, and the geographic location of the homes that are purchased to help Operation Home and the schools family housing and schools family housing to meet their goals. So once again, thank you very much for your support.
Thank you. Just real quickly, we'll wrap up. There is going to be a press conference at 11:30 today at the Portland Building, as well as the City of Portland Homeownership Fair. We hope to see a lot of folks there. And again, thanks for your leadership and your commitment to this. It's been great to work with such great partners in the Housing Center and in Home Street Bank and other community partners. So thank you.
Thank you, folks,
thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a sign-up sheet?
We did. That was all who signed up.
Any questions from the commissioners? It's a resolution. We'll take a vote. Please call the vote.
Sten? I'm sorry, Adams?
I'm going to say. Thank you for all your great ongoing work on this. Congratulations to Commissioner Sten and the mayor for this resolution, and look forward to much more to come. Aye.
Sten?
It's not easy to buy a house right now in Portland, but this hopefully will make it possible for some people that aren't getting there. And I think I said Hometown Bank. I wanted to say Home Street Bank. It's the Hometown Program, and they've just been terrific. And looking forward to getting there. And, of course, you know, the flip side of it is it's – I don't think Portland's market is going to slow down. I was predicting that every year for about 10 years and quit about 5 years ago, and I think it's going to keep going up, in part because we've all worked as a community to make it a nice place to live. So the flip side of how tough it is to get in is that it is really, once families get in, they are building a lot of equity and have a chance to really change their position financially. So hopefully we can help people get there, and thanks to Home Street once again, and I'm obviously glad to vote aye. And thanks to Mayor Potter for his help.
Potter.
Thank you, Commissioner Sten, for your leadership on this issue. And I really appreciate all the folks in the city who are working to provide more home ownership. It is one of the few ways that just average folks can begin to build wealth and something to pass down to their children. So this is really important. I appreciate businesses like Home Street Bank stepping forward to provide these kind of opportunities to our employees. You know, sometimes we're so busy out in the community, we forget that the folks in the city also need some of the same kinds of assistance. And so we are having a press conference at 11:30 plus an open house for employees so that they can look to see what is available and what the different programs and activities that they can get into a house with. So thank you all very much. It's greatly appreciated. Aye. Please read the 10 p.m. time certain. Read 454 and 455 together.
454, combined sewer overflow program update to City Council. And 455, accept evaluation and completion of the West Side Combined Sewer Overflow Tunnel Project Alternative Contract.
Commissioner Adams.
Thank you, Mayor. BES is here today to report to the Council on two important elements of our Willamette River Renaissance. First, we're going to hear some very positive news regarding the completion of the West Side CSO Big Pipe, the closeout of that portion of the project. This four-year project had a budget of $308 million and is complete and operating for $306 million. It was completed on time and was put into service in the time to catch the rain events of last November. We'll also hear today about the other elements of the West Side project important to the City Council, including job creation, the utilization of women, minority, and emerging contractors, how we engage the public in getting their help in partnership with meeting our goal of a cleaner river. The second item, we will get an update on how things are going for the East Side Big Pipe, currently under construction. As you know, this tunnel is bigger and more complex than the West Side Tunnel. And finally, we'll hear from representatives of the East Side CSO Review Committee. This committee, put together by the City Council, was established to provide us with independent citizen feedback and input as the project unfolds. And I'm pleased to introduce the leader of Bureau and Environmental Services, Dean Marriott.
Thank you, Commissioner, Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Dean Marriott. With me is Paul Gribben, who's our engineer in charge of both the West Side Big Pipe and East Side Big Pipe projects, and you'll hear from him in just a minute. I first want to thank a host of other city agencies that have helped us as we move forward with the West Side project. Purchasing, who is here today, was very helpful. The Fire Bureau that worked with our contractors to make sure that the workplace was safe and that we knew we could be rescued in case something happened. The City Attorney's Office obviously helped us with a lot of our legal issues, PDOT with transportation issues, Development Services with various permitting matters, and Parks for allowing us to be disruptive to Waterfront Park. Also, the Multnomah County with coordinating activities regarding the bridges, obviously a host of contractors and subcontractors. And I want to thank the City Council. I'm sorry Commissioner Saltzman is not here because much of the work associated with the West Side project was done while he was the Commissioner in charge of Environmental Services. And, of course, last but certainly not least, I want to thank the staff of the Environmental Services Bureau. Couldn't find a more dedicated and professional group of people. And I want to also thank my colleague Paul Gribben, who's sitting next to me, for shepherding this project through successfully. The first thing you see on in front of you is the timeline. We're 16 years down, 4 years to go on a 20-year program, and we're moving from left to right across this timeline, and we're approaching the finish line. Just recall that before we started, Portland had about 100 CSO events a year where untreated wastewater was getting into the river. And the target is to have that down to no more than 4 events per year, 3 of those in the wintertime when we're finished. So it's a robust goal, and we're well on our way of getting there. Just to mention, because people want to know how we stack up against other cities, I just came back from a national meeting where CSO communities get together annually to compare notes on how they're doing. We'll be finished before most other major cities in the country complete their work. The cost is anywhere from $500 million to about $3 billion. And what's not on this list is Chicago. They will approach about $4 billion when they're finished. So it's a national issue, and we're certainly not alone in this. We can take some solace in that we will, in fact, be finished before most other communities are. Our program, of course, just to refresh your recollection, involves cornerstone projects. It's getting stormwater out of the sewer system, and most of those efforts are now complete. We started with those. We then moved to tackling the problem associated with the Columbia Slough in North Portland. That project is now finished. Of course, it was brought online in the fall of 2000. And the Willamette was next with two parts, the West Side Tunnel Project and West Side Projects, and East Side, West Side, we're now happy to report today, is completed. So that leaves us with the East Side projects to finish. Here's the famous ski slope chart that shows what kind of progress we're making in, after all, what's important, and that is cleaning up the Willamette. The river is now cleaner and is getting better as we progress. Bringing the West Side project online has taken us to the 65% of CSO volumes are now controlled. If you look at this chart, when we started back in 1970, we discharged about 10 billion gallons a year of CSO to the river, and we're now down to about 2. So if you look at it from a historical perspective, since 1970, we've improved by about 80%. So it's a significant improvement. This slide just quickly shows you how many outfalls. We started with 54 combined sewer outfalls into the river and the Columbia Slough. 36 are now controlled. The last 19 are associated with the East Side project. It wasn't all tunneling. It hasn't all been tunneling. We've had some other very challenging projects. One of them is the Tanner Creek project. Tanner Creek started in the West Hills, flowed through the city and out to the Willamette. We decided to take that clean stream water out of the sewer system, put it in its own conveyance right to the river. And the next map will show you that some of you may recall we did a lot of work downtown in the Pearl District. We had to close Burnside a couple of times. We did Upper Burnside from 23rd all the way up the top of the hill. We did work along the Sunset Corridor, along the Sunset Highway just in the past year. Very complicated, very difficult and challenging. This work is now finished, and this line is now in service. I want to thank everybody for showing us a lot of patience with their driving habits and the neighborhoods for putting up with the construction over the years, but happy to say that project is finished. I want to just say a word about how we engage citizens, and the best way we engage citizens is through the Downspout Disconnection Project. Probably the most cost-effective thing we've done is we've taken 1 billion gallons of CSO out of the river by keeping all this water out of the collection system. We've got engaged citizens. We either paid them directly $53 a downspout to do it themselves, or if they didn't want to do it, we paid a community group to do it. We paid them $13 to go out. They could earn money by getting trained and going out and doing the work themselves. And we found this to be a very significant way of engaging people. If you were going to have this work done on your property, you learned a lot about clean rivers and what role you could play in doing so. So we not only educated a lot of people, we took 1 billion gallons of water off the system. And we did it for just about $9 million, incredibly cost effective. I'm going to turn it over to Paul now, who will summarize the completion of the West Side Tunnel and bring you up to date on where we go from here. Paul?
Paul Griffin, Chief Engineer for Environmental Services for the Willamette River CSO Tunnel Program. First, I just want to talk about the final contract closeout report for our contract with Imbrogilo S.A. Healy for the West Side. Just briefly, the West Side was a 3.5-mile-long tunnel, 120 feet deep, 14 feet diameter. We had 5 large shafts. We had a 220-million-gallon-per-day pump station and other facilities associated with it. The contract itself in 2002 dollars was $293 million. Inflation over the 4-year contract period was just over $15 million. So our subtotal, or our contract cost in 2006 dollars, was $308.3 million. The actual contract came in at a little over $306 million. So as Commissioner Adams said, we came in basically under our original contract amount. Oregon revised statutes require for any contract that was done under other than a competitive low bid approach that there be a public summary at the end summarizing the outcome. And we have to compare the actual costs with the original estimates, the number of project change orders, narrative description of successes and failures, and an objective assessment of the process compared with our original findings of fact. So that's what we're going to do right now. This is a final cost summary. It shows you a cumulative cost curve for the project, where our original, the dark gray line is the original cash flow for the project cumulative with time. And then the blue line shows you what the actual costs were and how they mesh with what we projected. So we came in basically right where we had originally projected. We did carry just under a $15 million contingency to cover risks in a job, but we ended up not having to use it. Contract changes. There were a total of 9 change orders to the contract itself. 6 were basically amendments to the general conditions that did not involve any time or cost. 2 extended the contract time, non-compensable time extension, a total of 50 days. And we did add 1 piece of work, the electrical substation at Swan Island Pump Station, which was originally going to be done by PGE, but it turned out to be quicker and more cost-effective to add it to Imbrogilo Healy's contract. Successes, there were a number of them, but in summary, this type of contract allowed a lot more cost and schedule control than a normal low bid would have. It was a cooperative effort between BES and Imbrogilo Healy. And we always knew where we were on costs. We could always project where we end up, where we would end up. There were a number of design changes that had to be made. One was a value engineering suggestion by Imbrogilo Healy before we started the contract to change the way we approached the pump station walls, which was probably close to a $20 million savings by itself. We also changed the construction of the operations and maintenance building. It saved about 3 months on the schedule. There was a lot more flexibility with minority women and emerging small business procurement. We originally estimated $13 million at the start, and we found out that opportunities came up that we hadn't anticipated over the 4 years, and so we ended up exceeding our goal. And this type of contract just allowed a partnership with Imbrogilo Healy and allowed the full use of the project talent to solve problems. We never had to take a position about whose fault anything was. We just went right into solutions. There were no contract claims, unresolved claims, and we never needed a dispute review board, which is pretty much standard. Dispute review boards are standard for the tunneling industry, and we didn't need one. Failures. Failure is kind of a strong word. There wasn't anything that we would consider was a failure. There was an area of concern in this type of contract, and that is subcontract management. We did have situations where there were additions to the scope of subcontracts that got ahead of approvals. There were some subcontractor extra work issues that we had some difficulty in resolution of. It's easy to get scope creep. In other words, the scope of a subcontract start to increase because it's easy for the prime to add work to a subcontract rather than put another subcontract out on the street. So these are some of the issues that we had to wrestle with, and learning from this we apply on the east side. The basic assessment of against the original findings of fact, what's highlighted in yellow are the subjects that we had to address in our findings of fact. In white was how it actually panned out. This did not limit competition in any way. The alternate approach created significant schedule savings and contributed to the on-time completion. The public benefits included a cleaner river, a timeliness, and we think this was our least cost approach. Value engineering, Imbrogilo Healy contributed significant cost savings ideas. There is, in my experience, there's no substitution for having a contractor on board before you're done with the design. They just have a whole different way of looking at things that ended up saving us quite a bit of money. The specialized expertise, the qualifications-based procurement ends up awarding the contractor the most qualified contractor. The market conditions, this type of contract actually opened it up beyond the U.S. market. So we had interest from European contractors that we would not have had under the low bid situation. The technology that was used, the mining technology had not been used in the U.S. before. And as far as funding sources are concerned, it was fully funded by capital bonds, but our rating has actually improved partly as a result of the success of this contract. And then on a local level, Imprezi Luhili had well over 200 subcontracts. 170 of them were with local minority women and emerging small businesses. As I said, we were shooting for $13 million. We had over $19 million in MWSB subcontracts. They had over 900 vendors and suppliers. $85 million went to Oregon-based vendors and subs. Over the 4 years, they had over 900 people employed, and at peak, we had 450 construction jobs on site. That is a wrap-up of the West Side. So we were done, came in time, under budget. And so with that, I'll just move into just a quick update on the East Side. Longer tunnel, bigger tunnel, 6 miles long, 22 feet in diameter, seven large shafts along the way. We have a number of other pipelines and structures to do. Currently underway, right now the tunnel boring machine is in place. It's assembled at the base of the upper shaft, and pending some electrical work, they expect to start the actual mining against the shaft wall will begin by mid this month. Other shaft work is also underway. Pipeline work is about to start. Other structures have already begun. And right now, the work is on schedule and is currently under budget. This is our current cost curve. It shows you, again, the original cash flow, which we project out to 2011, and then where we actually are. And you can see that we're under the budget. And there's two main reasons for that, since we are still on schedule. But some of the pipeline work that the contractor, Kiewit Bilfinger Berger, originally planned to do last summer, they moved to this summer because it turned out that their schedule was a little too aggressive, and it actually took a lot more planning. It doesn't affect the schedule at all. It just affects the cash flow. The second reason was the same on the major subcontractor for the slurry walls. They were originally going to do two sites at a time. They're actually back down to one, so the money is being spent slower. But again, it didn't affect the schedule at all. Minority women emerging small business, local business participation, the first 13 months of a 5 3/4 year contract time, there's 143 local subcontracts have been awarded, 124 of them are minority women emerging small businesses, $15 million in subcontract value is to MWSB firms, and $8 million is in other local subcontracts, and that's where we stand right now. Our goal on MWSBs was $26 million. So in the first year, Kiewit Bilfinger Berger has already done more than half. Significant challenges upcoming in the near future. As I said, the initial mining operation will start in the next couple of weeks. It will be very slow. It will be very careful. Breaking out of the shaft is risky work, so they'll be moving very slowly and very carefully. We've also got pipeline work coming up along Southeast 2nd Avenue in the heart of the Central East Side Industrial District, and that's going to take a lot of coordination with the local businesses, so it's going to be difficult work. And our public involvement focus is continual personal contact with individual businesses, especially in the Central East Side, and our focus will be on maintaining business operations at all our work sites. Traffic notifications, interpretive signs, and we're also meeting regularly with the businesses for Clean Rivers. And with that, that concludes our report. We do have two people from the East Side Review Committee who will give you their look at the East Side project.
Do you want us to have them report to you and then come back if you have questions, or if you have questions, you can?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll come back up.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, would you please state your name for the record?
Good morning. My name is Bill Martinek. I'm here today with Derek Chisholm. We are both members of the East Side CSO Overflow Project Review Committee, and we're here to give our second report as to how the committee is functioning. So good morning, Honorable Mayor and Commissioners and interested members of the public. Our committee was put together last year, and since that time, we have met about 12 times now. We did do our initial report back to the council in September of 2006, and so we'd like to take a few minutes this morning to just give you an update of how our committee is operating and what we've seen and heard since that time. Probably what I could do is just say, well, you heard all of it from Paul, because he gave you a very good update of where we're at right now. So just to take a minute, we feel very fortunate that we are working with an extremely talented group of individuals, both in members of the BES committee and also with the contractor, with Kiewit Bilfinger. It's a great group of highly talented individuals that have come together for this project. So the city of Portland is extremely lucky in that respect, and the project is moving ahead as planned. A few of the items that we are reviewing, we look at, of course, the schedule. We've looked at seen the timely delivery of the tunnel boring machine. Again, as Paul stated, the machine is down in the initial pit at the opera site, and final preparations are getting ready to launch that machine out of its initial shaft. So that's a big step. Also, there have been good efforts put in place to put in effect an emergency response program, and that has also been tested one time with various emergency response members, local fire and rescue, and other agencies coming together just to practice what will need to take place in case there is an emergency at the site. We've also reviewed the project's critical path, and as Paul stated, we are in the very initial stages, but all of the items that are on that schedule have gone very well up to this date, and the acquisition of permits and right-of-ways has gone out ahead of the actual work, so it's coming along as was planned. And there has been a lot of work done by the business outreach committee to make sure that all of the impacts to the east side businesses have been addressed, and we have talked about that numerous times in our meetings as just to how well that's going and whether there have been any complaints, and we have not addressed any complaints to this date. So, but we are moving into a time when there's going to be a lot more activity on the surface streets there. So that's something that'll really kick into gear this summer. Also, the contractor has done an excellent job, as if you looked up at the slide there, as far as being able to identify and break down portions of this project to bring in the smaller area contractors, especially the minority women and emerging small businesses. The contractor has done an outstanding job. They're already halfway to their goal for the whole job, and we're only in the first year. So it's just been amazing how they've been able to identify portions of the project that could be accomplished by local contractors and bring them into the project. We've also talked about making sure that the utilization of labor and operators and the apprenticeship part of that is being tracked right now and identifying areas where apprenticeship labor, in not only operators but also laborers and carpenters, can be brought into the project. That's somewhat of a challenge. This is an extremely difficult project, and a lot of the work does not lend itself to the on-site training of apprenticeship employees. And so Kiewit is working very hard to identify the areas where apprentices can be brought onto the site and be utilized in a safe manner. So with that, I'll turn over to Derek. And
thank you. Good morning. Derek Chisholm. I work with Parametrics in the Lloyd District. He reviewed most of the major items, and Paul did as well. So we track things systematically on a monthly basis, and then we look into issues as they arise. There have been three very minor safety incidents, so we've been talking to the contractors about how they intend to tighten up the systems. They're still well within industry standards and beating state goals, but once something arises, then we talk about it and set plans in place. most of those are big issue items like the critical path. And so that's really going to be our focus now as the TBM is about to start its work and the most serious work of the project, the most challenging work is about to begin. That'll become our focus, but not at the sacrifice of any of the other issues regarding apprenticeships, MWESB hiring, et cetera. So that's all the comments I had.
This is very laborious work to serve on a committee as our extra eyes and ears and brains, and I just want to thank you and pass along back to your fellow committee members a big thanks. It's very important, a project this big and this complicated with so many judgment calls based on the best information we can get together is only improved by your work, and I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Is anybody signed to testify?
No one else signed up.
Okay. Item 454 is requires no council action. Okay. Further questions for BES?
If I could just take the opportunity to thank you, Dean, for your work on this project over the years. And big thanks to the thin edge of the wedge on this project, but doing a great job, Paul. You've absolutely been fantastic and I've on this project, and I've really grown to appreciate just how good you are and how lucky we are to have you on such an incredibly difficult project. So thank you.
Yeah, I need a motion to accept.
I was listening.
On time, on budget.
I was listening.
Yeah. Motion to accept the report.
So moved.
Second. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Thank you very much. It is great work.
Sten?
Terrific work.
Potter?
I'm just very impressed with the work that was done. I really want to compliment you, Dean, and folks for exceptional job of keeping it on budget, in fact, under budget. And I'm looking forward to completion of the East Side pipe as well. So thank you, and please convey that to your staff.
I will. Thank you very much.
All right. Please read, we'll go to the regular agenda first item.
We need a vote on 455.
Pardon me?
455, we need a vote on.
That was 455.
Oh, 454, I'm
454
sorry.
454 does not require, it's just a program update.
Oh, it's a presentation, I'm sorry.
So we'll move to the regular agenda, 480.
Authorized contract with Dignity Village to manage transitional housing campground at Sunderland Yard.
Commissioner Sten and Adams.
I just got a note that you want to send it over. Is that right?
It's my understanding that this matter was going to be set over for hearing on next, I think, Wednesday.
May 9th at 2:45, time certain, is what your staff asked
I would
for.
Ask Mayor that we set it over till May 9th at 2:45.
Certainly. Any objection? Please read item 481.
Pay claim of Roxy Granville and Lisa Washington.
Commissioner Leonard.
Thank you, Mayor Potter. do you want to come forward in case there might be any questions? This is a settlement of a variety of claims by two employees of the Bureau of Development Services. And as you recall, last year, I actually asked that we appeal this. In the intervening time with the further conversations I've had with City Attorney's Office, with the Bureau of Development Services staff, I didn't change my mind that, in fact, became more convinced that Paul Scarlett and his top managers would not be motivated and are not motivated by any employee's race, sex, or religious affiliations. But what did become clear is that, as is in the case sometimes of large organizations, that the rules were not of the organization were not as enforced as consistently
as I think reasonably should be expected. And for that reason, the issue that arose to the lawsuit appeared to be an unusual circumstance that some concluded was motivated by these women's race. I concluded that it was because we needed to do a better job as an organization supervising employees, enforcing rules consistently, evenly, and without exception. Because of that, we've made some significant changes at the Bureau of Development Services. EEO, the Equal Employment Opportunity Officer, is no longer a person in the chain of command that also would be responsible for discipline. I felt that that was a conflict. So we've created a new position, hired, promoted from within Mikhail Shabazz, who is now the EEO and on par with the top managers at the Bureau of Development Services and works with issues of workplace problems. And he is the person employees should now be comfortable going to and having issues discussed and resolved that could be, for an example, like what we are dealing with here. We're making other management changes, including developing a systematic and consistent training program for all supervisors, which I think this case points to the need of. It was after much, much discussion and negotiation and I think soul searching that I came to the place where this was a fair settlement for the organization and for the women involved. And I think that as a result of this, the Bureau of Development Services is going to be a much more healthy place for all employees to work and supervisors on down. So I would appreciate the council's support of this resolution.
Any questions for the attorney?
No one signed up.
I guess for the record, just for the record, for anyone that might be listening in, judging from Commissioner Leonard's comment, that this settlement, in your opinion, is less likely to be less costly than pursuing some other action.
Commissioner Adams, I'm Harry Auerbach with the City Attorney's Office. It is the settlement accomplishes a lot of things. It resolves more than the lawsuit, so it's difficult to say, you know, just in pure dollars, comparing whether we did settle or didn't settle. The lawsuit. We're paying us a premium above the judgment, but we're getting additional benefits in return for that. And so the answer I can give you is that based on conversations that we've had with risk management, with BHR, with the Bureau, and with the Commissioner's Office, the package is in the best interest of the city.
Emergency vote. Please call a vote.
Aye. Adams.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Voted twice.
Sten.
I just wanted to note for the record, I did abstain from the last vote because the simple reason, Lisa Washington's an old friend of mine. We went to high school together, and it was contested, I didn't think it was appropriate in that I didn't think I had clear judgment on it. Given that it's an emergency ordinance and we need four votes and that both sides agree to this, I don't see any reason not to vote aye.
Potter.
Aye. We've got a couple of issues I think that we should deal with. The emergency ordinances first. We've got two, and then we have two four-fifths items to vote on. So what I'd like to do is move ahead to those and then pick up the others as we find time. So I think the next emergency is 487.
487, authorized agreement for acquisition of two parcels of real property in East Portland for park purposes from Stephen and Dorothy Sneer.
Is anybody from Parks Bureau here? Any questions from the commissioners regarding this property? Is there anyone signed up to testify on the matter?
I did not have a sign-up sheet.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify on this matter? Emergency vote, please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 488.
Authorize acceptance of a conservation easement from Oregon Health and Science University for approximately 42 acres of real property situated on Markham Hill.
Is there anybody from staff to speak to this?
I think that's me. I just heard that. This is an agreement that we had had with OHSU through the Markham Hill plan that was approved several years back in 2002 that had to do with rezoning residential property to open space, and that it was agreed that the city would accept from OHSU conservation easement, and this is the document that provides that.
Any questions? Is there anyone signed up to testify on this matter?
I did not have a sign-up sheet.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify on this matter? Okay, this is a non-emergency and does move to a second reading, so thank you. I need a motion to suspend the rules and to hear 2/4 items.
So moved.
Second.
Call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 488-1.
Create 2 new represented classifications of emergency communications call taker and emergency communications police dispatcher.
And for the record, Yvonne Deckard, director for the Bureau of Human Resources. Can we take both of those ordinances together?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead and please read 488-2.
Authorize a letter of understanding with AFSCME Local 189-2 for terms and conditions of employment of represented employees in the local bargaining unit in the Bureau of Emergency Communications.
These two ordinances are actually one piece of cloth. I was before you about a year ago.
Just state your name for the record.
All right, okay. For the record, my name is Yvonne Deckard, Director for the Bureau of Human Resources. About a year ago, I was before you and asking council to support a resolution which was to put in place a pilot program out at the Bureau of Emergency Communication between Bureau management in their labor management process to deal with the recruitment and retention issues, long-term recruitment and retention issues that's impacted that organization for quite some time. Council did endorse that, and the Bureau, in cooperation with, come on up.
Sorry.
No problem. With the Bureau Director, along with Commissioner Leonard's office and BHR, has worked over the last 12 months to bring together this recruitment and retention project. What you have before you today is the work out of that committee. The first ordinance is calls for us to create 2 new classifications by which developing a series of classifications that will enable the Bureau to have more flexibility in being able to assign and utilize the talents and the expertise of the employees at the 911 center. We think that that's very critical in order to deal with our long-term retention and recruitment issues. It will establish 2 new classifications, that one that will be that is a call taker and the other that is a EC police dispatch. And so at that, by adding those in, we will have a series of 4 classifications, correct, which would allow us to decrease the rate of washout for the employees during training, and will allow us to staff up fully I think, in the long term. The other ordinance is a change to the labor agreement, and this tentative agreement has been ratified by the 911 operators and now is before council for ratification. And to give you some idea of the changes in this memorandum of agreement, it will call for some revisions in the overtime premium upon working 12 hours of voluntary overtime in one pay period. It would allow an employee to get a $50 premium. This is not to apply to supervisors or attending classes or meeting or special detail. It's really to try to deal with the overtime stress that employees have in that operation. Ordered overtime, it increases or it establishes a bonus for ordered overtime for employees with the exception of what I would call high peak times, such as, Fat Tuesday, St. Patrick's Day, Cinco de Mayo, 4th of July, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Christmas Eve, and New Year's Eve, and New Year's. It will allow for anniversary benefits as it relates to how employees actually bid for vacation time that would allow employees to have more control, for lack of a better term, over their life and being able to plan for time outside of work. It once again creates the call taker classifications. There is in developing these series of classifications, it actually calls for a 6% increase in the range over the range for those classifications in the labor agreement. So that's a 6% increase to the ranges. So at this point, I'll see.
Maybe I can just summarize. I probably should have done this first, and then your comments would have probably fit better. There has been a historic problem at the Bureau of
Emergency
Communications. That was the last one. Bureau of Development Services at the Bureau of Emergency Communications and staffing. It used to be, if you'll remember, when we used to get the annual survey of what employees earned in the city, we historically had a emergency communications operator always be the number one employee in the city. And the reason is because we have this historic shortage of operators. And we've tried various strategies in the last 4 years to try to get to how to get more operators through training. We have the spots. We have the funding. We can't get the people trained and certified and into the spots. And as a result, we have employees that are existing employees working a tremendous amount of overtime and something that is really unusual, forced overtime, actually being told you can't go home. You have to work overtime. Because obviously this is not one of those services that it's okay to shut down, even for a short period of time. When somebody calls 911, they have a reasonable expectation somebody's going to answer the phone. So the result has been a lot of workplace issues. And so what we've done here is we've actually created a position, recreated it, that used to exist, of a call taker. So it used to be, up until we adopt this, that we would hire a person to be a 911 dispatcher. They'd begin going through training, do call taking great. But as soon as they hit the phones for police or fire, those skills that are so important for those jobs were not there. So we'd have to let the person go, although they did fine taking calls. So what we recognized was important was to be able to keep those people hired to take calls, because that's a vital function. I mean, that's the first step in police, fire, and emergencies. When you police, fire, or medical, when you pick up the phone and when you call 911 and somebody picks up the phone, that's the first thing that's said, and that's that person, the call taker. And so we've created a position now for those people to be able to fill that will relieve them taking experienced dispatchers off the front line and coming to take calls, because we have those folks. So we expect overtime to go down as a result of that. We also sat with the union and came up with this more fair compensation, even though it's not the collective bargaining agreement is not up. We were trying to address this entire issue of staffing, forced overtime, morale, and this package reflects that with these call takers, with these 6% spreads between positions. And we're hoping